The whole business with mindfulness is actually distortion. That I've done this model before. There's Steve Armstrong also used it too, Utejaniya. So there's clear awareness, and there's what we're looking at, and we look through the attitudes in the mind. So if the mind is clear and light, generous, open, etc., then you tend to see what's there. If there's grasping, aversion, you know, whole shtick stuff going on, then what you see is distorted. And we tend not to see that because we're looking through the attitudes in the mind rather than at them. Mm-hmm. So the easiest way you can tell if the mind has distortions in it is just check and see if there's any tension or tightness. So you're sitting there, you know, and if you're pushing hard, you feel that tightness. It's really, really wise to relax it. Buddha said a lot about that, actually. It's, translations are difficult, but it's all through the suttas.
Doug, what do you mean by tightness? Is that the word you used?
Yeah, tension, tightness, thickness.
Yeah.
So make a fist.
Uh-huh.
Relax it. You notice the difference?
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's really that simple. And it can be mental tightness, too. I mean, you all know when it's like... Mm-hmm. In fact, when there's mental tightness, it can easily lead to headaches or pressure, you know, particularly up through here, back of the head.
You know, I can see the physical sensation, but I'm not quite that there's a deeper meaning to it that I'm not getting somehow.
There is no deeper meaning. You're getting it.
Yeah.
It's really, really simple. It's not metaphysical.
So if I listen to music when I'm cleaning, for example, and I'm joyful in that present, even though the music has words and, is that distracting, is that sensual, you know what I mean? There's a difference when I'm sitting in front of a computer and I'm working.
Yeah.
I get the tension, I feel that. If I turn on music, it actually helps relax. So, you know, is that distraction or, I mean?
I am a great one for empirical trials. You know, if you do that and it actually leads to more clarity and lightness, then I think it's skillful. If it leads to more tension and distraction, then it's not. And I find that there are some things with music, there are times when it's really helpful and there's times when it's a distraction. And so you just have to try it on to see. Also, in case you didn't notice in this, there's nothing about drugs and alcohol. Did you notice that?
Yeah. That's
so you're off the hook. So what happened is the first four precepts, the language in it, preceded the Buddha by a long time. The Jains use exactly the same wording, the first four. And somewhere the ninth or tenth year of the Buddha's ministry, he was visiting Kosambi, which is a city in India, a small city. And as they approached the outer gate, there was a monk who was passed out cold drunk beside the road. A drunk monk. Yeah, say that four times. And within a couple months after that, the fifth precept was added. It was really bad for the Sangha, you know. I just want to dig into the first precept, the one about killing, for a little bit, and some of the questions that you're raising, I think, will come out from that. Okay. So what I would say, and it gets to the music, and it gets to all these other things, that in the relative world in which we live, there are no absolutes. There simply are no absolutes. So the precepts are not a behavioral code that we're supposed to stick with at all costs.
In the suttas, is it say killing?
Striking. The word is actually striking.
Yeah, that's closer to doing no harm.
That's right.
Like doing no harm better. And then, you can wound somebody pretty badly.
Right.
And without killing them.
Well, and the other thing, when the Buddha took these on, he took on a lot of practices he used elsewhere, and he always, not always, but oftentimes he gave it his own twist. And his twist on this was he was saying the intention is actually more important than the action. So if you take non-striking and the intention is more important, then it sounds like it's saying not acting out of ill will. And you notice in this, it's number 9 or something in the list actually says that explicitly. But the word is striking in Pali, but it's almost universally translated as non-killing. So let's talk about that one for a little bit. I had the first little creature that was given to me into my care was a tabby cat, who I named Susie. I was about 8 years old at the time. And we became very close. She slept on my bed, sometimes at my pillow. I actually helped her deliver kittens. I felt really, and she kind of convulsed and pushed them out of her body and then kind of licked them to life. I felt very close to her. When I was, I think it was about 11, I was walking out of the backyard as my father was backing our Chevy station wagon out of the garage. And just as I came around the corner, I saw Susie go under the wheel. And she was lying there on her side. My father felt the unnatural bump and got out of the car. And she was lying on her side. Seemed to be unable to get her feet underneath her, and she was thrashing so violently that her body was being tossed. It must have been, you know, 5-6 inches up in the air. My father said something about a knife and throat and rushed into the kitchen. I didn't think I could watch that. And I looked over, and there was this yellow wastebasket, a big kitchen plastic wastebasket that had been washed out and was sitting by the back door. So I put the hose in there and filled it up, and as carefully as I could lifted her as she was thrashing and lowered her head first into the water. Mm. And as soon as her head went underwater, her movements became surprisingly coordinated. And so I just held on a little more firmly. Mm. And after a few moments, she stopped struggling, and I slowly threw my hands out of the water and left her sitting there. Mm-hmm. And I looked up, and my father was standing on the back steps at that time. He had a long knife, carving knife in his hand, watching me. He didn't say anything, which was very much like my father. So I got up and I walked into the backyard to be by myself. And about a half an hour later, I looked down and I noticed there were these long, deep scratches up and down both my forearms. Mm-hmm. I still couldn't feel them.
May I ask something? Maybe? I bike a lot, and I've lost everything in my former life. And I imagine diving under a car with my bike and how good it would be, because it's suicidal. Now, I would suppose that would be ill will as well. You know? I mean, wouldn't it? Suicidal thing?
Yeah. We all have to figure this out ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of a general principle, I think people have a right to do what they will with their life. I think that emotionally driven suicide is always tragic.
Mm-hmm.
Is always tragic. I had a woman who came to me whose 10-year-old son had just died of leukemia after a long, kind of gory pain, and she was quite suicidal. And she believed in reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
So I told her if she killed herself, she would lose her body, but everything else would be there. And and that little maneuver, and I pretty much believed it at the time. I wasn't sure, but and that was enough to keep her alive for 3 or 4 months. At which time she was no longer suicidal, and she was just seriously depressed, and she said to me, "Well, I guess I'm cured." And I said, no, there's a lot better than this. Mm-hmm. You know, so we worked together for another, I was a psychotherapist, I worked with her for another couple of years. Mm-hmm. And she went on and had a very rich, you know, life, you know, since then. Done a lot of work with kids, and, you know, very full. And so I've been down that road with a lot of people, and I think when there's emotionally based suicide, that we've just kind of lost vision, you know, of what's possible.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm planning to do, is become a special ed teacher after my other kind of teaching.
What I usually say is that, you know, there's something in that impulse that is actually wise. Mm. You know, there's something that needs to die. Just don't take it too literally. Mm. That's when the problem comes in.
Just don't take it what?
Too literally.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Yeah, the old self has to die.
Mm. What other kind of suicide is there than emotional suicide?
Oh, you know, if Susie... Look, I mean, she wasn't trying to commit suicide. No, it wasn't. But, you know, there are people who, you know, have irreversible pain. And if they have a lot of, a tremendous amount of clarity and can see that with an undistorted mind, I think there's a tremendous depth that can happen out of it. But, you know, if there's somebody that's just sucked in and lost in that, and their quality of life is shot. And medically, you know, it's really been confirmed that there's no, you know, medical science really has no answer for what's going on. I don't see that as much as an emotionally based suicide. And it's real tricky, and people come out in different places, but I don't want to be in a position of saying what somebody else, you know, can do. I have I've had cats all my life. Billy was 19, which is very old for a cat, and he became lame and a little bit confused and disoriented, and sometimes he would sit beside our bed, you know, for a half an hour and just cry. But I would look at him, you know, very carefully and sort of openly, and he would spend most of the day, you know, he's sleeping on the bed or sleeping out in various places in the garden, and, you know, my deepest sense was that, you know, despite all that, he still wanted to be here. And then one day, Erica, my wife, called me, and I went out there, and there was Billy lying on his side, in the garden, and there were ants crawling over him, including across his eyelids. Mm-hmm. He wasn't able to blink anymore, and he was still breathing.
Oh, dear.
And, you know, and Eric and I looked at him, and it was just clear to us that he didn't want to be here. Mm-hmm. You know, he was done. He was done. Inside himself. And I thought about drowning him in a hot tub that was right there, but I remembered Susie, and so we picked him up, and there was a vet about 4 or 5 blocks from us, and took him there and got him a lethal injection as we were patting him. Mm. Traditionally, the first precept, it's usually translated as non-killing, and there are places where the Buddha says that to break this precept, you have to do 4 things. You have to know a being who you wish harm or want to die, second thing. Third thing is you have to do something that 4 results in their death. So my killing of Susie and Billy meets all those criteria. And I deeply grieved their death, but I lost my notes. I deeply grieved their passing, but I really feel at peace with what I did. Kindness and alleviating a friend's suffering to me took precedence over all that. And if I accumulated some bad karma out of that, to not do it felt like selfish. One should be accumulating bad karma too. And I'm not really sure I accumulated bad karma. I would do it again.
You would do it again?
I would do it again, yeah, under those circumstances. And what's really important for me is checking, you know, as deep as I can about where they are inside. That for me is the most important thing.
Yeah, where we are.
Yeah, well, and that's actually part of it. But for me, you know, with a creature I love, what's going on for them, and whether they want to be here or not, and the pain, that's actually more important. I have more time to work my stuff out. But, you know, people come in different places with this.
But isn't it compassion?
I think so. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Ultimately.
Yeah, compassion, kindness. Let me just throw another thing in here. Despite my willingness, you know, to kill loved ones in some circumstances, I think there are some ways that the Buddhist precept about non-killing doesn't go far enough. Buying hamburger doesn't meet the Buddhist criteria, right? I don't know that specific animal. I don't wish a particular one any harm, and not doing anything that directly results in their death. Animal did die, but in order, and then this is, I'm just talking traditionally, within the tradition, to break the precept, all four of those things have to happen. So from the Buddhist tradition, eating hamburger does not break precept against killing. It doesn't. Buddha was not vegetarian. He took whatever was offered. But for me, living in a world of supply and demand, I know when I eat meat, it creates a little more demand for cow meat, which has a little influence on the death of an animal. And so that just leaves me with some qualms about all that. So I was purely vegetarian for a number of years, ate eggs and milk products, but I didn't, as I tell my wincing friends, I wouldn't eat any flesh. But that was my line. And then an acupuncturist convinced me that my blood protein was really way too low. And she said, you know, I ought to be eating some fish or something. And she reminded me, you know, that we evolved in these bodies that had meat as part of their diet. And her reassurances weren't really comforting for me, because I knew I could get all the protein I needed from vegetables. It just took a lot more work that I wanted to put into it. And as I reflected further, you know, none of us can survive without eating something that was once alive, right? I had a friend once who would not eat plants that had to be killed, would not eat anything that had to be killed. So he would eat lettuce, you know, or spinach, but wouldn't eat celery because you have to kill the whole plant, or fruit or nuts, but nothing that would kill the whole plant. To me, it just seemed like philosophical hair splitting. There are many Native Americans that say that's what's really important is to be humble and mindful and grateful to the animal that, or organism that died, you know, so that we could survive. So today, I still don't eat any flesh, except occasionally some fish. And as I was pulling all this stuff together and writing this out, it just, to me, where I've come to this sounds like sort of a convenient rationalizing, right? A sort of a self-centered, you know, feels good and do it. And I don't know, maybe that's true. But I'm not suggesting in any way that you deal with this the way I have. What I am really saying is that in the relative world, there are no absolutes. And we all have to wrestle with this and have to wrestle with the consequences of our actions. And I think the way that we engage these precepts and engage the beings around us is in the long run is vastly more important than any particular conclusion. So let's look at this a little more deeply, okay? Because I don't think the Buddha intended the precepts to be used quite literally. So what was it all about? The goal of spirituality is not to rigidly adhere to any code of conduct. That's not what it's about. It's about cultivating a mind-heart, as I was saying before, that is free of distortion. A mind-heart that is free of distortion can see clearly and heartfully and is present, can see how the mind operates, how the mind's attention moves. And when we can see that clearly enough, we wake up. If we were fully enlightened beings, if we were, you know, we'd gone the whole distance, then if it feels good, it's okay, would be a very good criteria. I think that would work. As Thich Nhat Hanh said, when we're mindful, we know what to do and what not to do. Sounds really simplistic, but I just love it because it's very, when we are mindful, we know what to do. And not, we don't have to figure it out. When the awareness is strong enough, we know what to do and what not to do. The problem is that this side of enlightenment, none of us are actually clear enough. Our perceptions, our feelings, our actions, our thinking, the stuff we do get deeply distorted. So if it feels good, there are lots of things that we do that in the moment feel good, right? And later we think, oh, I can't really believe I did that, right? We all have that. Are there things that we feel bad about or feel guilty about and we don't do it, and later and say, ah, you know, that was hard. I wish I'd followed through on it. So because of this propensity that we have for confusion, I think it helps to have some tools to navigate the world. And I think this is the context in which the Buddha presented these precepts as tools to help us navigate. So I think what he was seeing is that there is a relationship between certain qualities of mind, qualities of awareness, and certain behaviors and certain actions. A relationship. He considered some qualities to be unwholesome. You know, when high on his list were things like desire, grasping, aversion, confusion, willful ignorance. Collectively, those are called
hindrances.
Those particular ones are tanha. Yes, they are hindrances, and the hindrances expand out from that, right? Killing is most likely to arise in everyday life when we have unwholesome qualities. So there are some behaviors that the Buddha generally considered were unskillful, and high on his list, you know, were killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, intoxicants, etc. Gossiping, idle chatter, rumors, all that stuff we like to do, right? So so what happens is that as we're going through our life, if we're in those unwholesome qualities, it's much easier to spot behaviors, killing, harming, hitting, than it is the ill will inside. Right. So what the precepts say is that these are behaviors that when they arise, it's like, whoa, you may want to take a minute and just see what's going on inside. There are things we do that may require some a little more mindfulness. Or when we're, you know, when we're tempted, just actually step back and see what's going on. So as you can see from this perspective, killing Susie and Billy really wasn't a problem. As Terry was saying, it was kindness and compassion that was the motivation there.
And I like this idea of intention. I mean, I don't think your dad should have bad karma because he didn't see your first cat. And if he would have seen her, he wouldn't have run over.
That's right.
And he didn't have the intention to do it.
Right.
So I think that intention thing.
Yeah. So, you know, the Tibetans have a little more nuanced way of looking at it, which I think is really true, that the intention is the most important thing. But, you know, how many of you have driven down the road and had an animal jumped in front of you? And maybe you tried to swerve to avoid it and you hit it anyway. And you can feel, you know, you can feel the adrenaline, you can feel all that stuff that comes back through your system. And so I think the act itself does have some effect, but it's the intention. It's really, and so what the Tibetans say is there's the act, there is the state of mind and the heart you were in when you committed the act, and it's how you felt afterwards. You know, if you did something and feel a lot of remorse, it's really a quite different situation than if you, you know, kill something after it's like, not my problem.
I always hear intention related to the first precept, but I wonder if it applies to all the other precepts.
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Speaking ill will, if you don't intend it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And if it causes damage, then there's a little bit, you know, it's less. But, you know, because oftentimes, I don't know, you look in the environmental movement, there's a lot of things a lot of people have done with all the best intentions that as the science evolved, say, whoops, that was a bad idea. So, you know, there is some collective karma that happens back from that. But, you know, the intentions were okay, so you can have a mind-heart that's relatively relaxed as long as you're not callous, you know, to the effects of it. I had a woman came to me who was part of the Gay-Straight Alliance in her high school. And there was a guy who... It just sounds classic. He was a football star in high school, and he was secretly gay, and so he was talking to him about it, and they encouraged him to come out, and he did, and his parents took it very poorly. They were you know, a fundamentalist Christian, and a couple of weeks later he committed suicide. And so she came into me because people kept on saying what her intentions were. You know, her intentions were good, and they were, and they were. And I saw that, and I looked at her, and I said, you will never know. You will never know what the effect of your encouragement had on that. And that that's what it means to be an adult. You know, that you make a call based on the best information, on the clearest intentions you have. And then you actually live with the results. And I could see there was something that was just relaxed. It's like, okay, you know. So actually got a place where she could work with it. So it's very complicated stuff.
My current practice revolves around you know, the not killing precept and mm-hmm. prior military and prior law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hard struggle, you know, when you load a 2,000-pound bomb and you know where it's going. And, or you have firearms pointed at people trying to, or you see a, you know, a sheriff's firm with a sniper out on the skid going to end the threat to kill two officers or whatever. And how can we judge that on what
We can't. And the judging mind is not, I want to say it's not appropriate. It happens a lot. So it's really important to understand how karma works. Karma is tension. That's all it is. It's tension. You know, so there's a place inside that says, oh my goodness, you know, look what happened. And so that reverberates back through your system, and it has an effect. But it's not magical. And, you know, and so if you work with it and see where the tension is and gradually release that, and sometimes that can release all, you know, kinds of grieving and regret and remorse and all that, and so you just keep on, well, you know, I have this thing called the 6 R's, just recognizing what's going on, releasing it, letting it be what it is, relaxing, bring some lighter mind to that. You know, if there are deep things that you have a lot of regret for, that'll come up a lot, but gradually you work the tension out of it, and then the karma is gone.
Yep.
So none of this is preordination. Not preordained. It's not ordination. You know what I mean.
Predetermined.
Yeah. All of this is workable. It's not workable if you shut it down. Then it just remains locked underneath there. And so that's part of the deal, is finding skillful ways to bring up stuff that you have. And it's like this woman I was talking about, it's like sort of acknowledging that she may have well have had some role in this guy's death. And to have somebody who was willing to say that actually gave her a place where she could start to work with that. As long as everybody was nice, say, you're fine. She knew inside she wasn't, you know. So she can work with that. But it takes, you know, awareness is magic. But it takes that clear, open awareness to be with what is. And all wise view means is that we're not trying to distort it. We try to see it as clearly just what is. Wise view is not a particular perspective. It's like seeing what's going on as clearly as we can. And it is really magical because you go deeply enough and clearly enough and things will release. Okay.
So?
Ginger has a question. Ginger?
Yeah, well, I've had this issue for a long time, but it's hard to let go of something you keep running into all the time, but a saying with right speech is better to speak to the person. If I can't speak to the person, it's hard. Not speaking to others to resolve issue, to have peace.
The thing that's most important in all that is the inner state. What are the qualities of the mind, heart, and the relative world? There are no absolutes. I mean, I agree with you in general. You know, talking to the person is generally better than not talking to the person, but not always. And it's these empirical trials. You know, if you do something 2 or 3 times and it blows back at you, it's like, whoa. So the most important thing about empirical trials is that you pay attention to the data. You know? I know this will work. It's 170 times, 171. Maybe this will work.
But you don't want war. Somebody's trying to have war with you and probably find more problems, create more problems. You want peace. There has to be some resolution, just like countries that keep fighting. If they don't want to come to some agreement, there's never peace.
So the first ennobling truth is that in this world, everything breaks. Right? We all die. Doesn't mean we can't have a lot of joy, etc., etc., but if we get locked into a model. I mean, I think about the old farmers, you know, a couple hundred years ago. Tree falls on the barn. Well, that happens. Let's see what we can do. You know, now, tree falls on my house. What did I do wrong? And, you know what? I create a bad car. All that sort of, you know, bad stuff happens. bad stuff happens. Our culture has done us an incredible disservice by telling us that we are in charge of our lives. We are the masters of our fate. We got influence. But by golly, bad things happen to good people all the time. They really do. And so what we're after is how to be at peace with this. The bad things happen. And if there's grasping for some result, I want to have a peaceful relationship with you. Damn it. It doesn't really work. So I would say no situation there is forgiveness. You can forgive the person. There may not be reconciliation. Reconciliation takes two people agreeing and working it out. Forgiveness only requires one person. It's just, you let go of the rope. You're not playing tug of war anymore.
Just stay at peace in the turmoil. Just feel it, all the stuff falling apart. I feel like you're in a hurricane.
It works if you can feel it with a mind that is relatively clear. If your mind is a hurricane, then you're looking through a lot of distortions, and that's not going to help. It really isn't. So if there's a hurricane going on, maybe you need to go off and watch some Laurel and Hardy movies. Hardy movies. Laurel horror movies. Never mind. You know, anything that actually gets the mind heart relaxed, you know, a little bit, and get it to unwind a little. And then from that place, you can come back and look at it. But, you know, if you're there all tight and stuff like that, you actually just create more karma. It's all that tension that's just building up inside, you know. So you have to, you know, find some peacefulness. And if your peacefulness is dependent on what somebody else's does, then boy, you are trapped.
Yeah.
You are trapped. Okay. Got more stuff, or should I go on a little bit?
Just one thing. What if someone just breaks all of these? You know, a guy goes off and gets drunk and angry and kills someone and then has wrongful sex or whatever. What is his karma just going to get so wrecked in that one day that just there's no way back?
No.
Whoa. Being so unmindful of everything.
You know the Jataka tales? They're tales of the Buddha in previous lives, and there's a Jataka tale where he was on a ship with 500 people, and the captain, you heard this one? And the captain was going to sink the ship and kill everybody. So the Buddha to be killed, the pirate, captain. Number one, because, you know, one death as opposed to 500, but also to spare the guy all the karma of killing 500 people, you know? In the absolute, there, you know, in the relative world, there are no absolutes. You can always come back for it. But you have to be really careful. The precepts are tools for mindfulness to looking at your life. Mm-hmm. If you want to go out and judge people, that's not what they're meant for. I know we do it all the time, but that's not what they're about. The judging mind is better to have compassion for their suffering. You know, they're hurting. Anybody can do that is hurting. You may want to take all the sharp objects out of their hands. So I used to say about Dick Cheney, he can believe whatever he wants. I just want to take all the sharp objects out of his hands. You know, then I how are we doing here for time? Okay, we got a little bit more. The times when we are most likely to kill are actually when we're dealing with pests. Mosquitoes, bugs, cockroaches, all those sorts of things. And what happens inside is that that we say, you know, the inconvenience this creature is bringing me, is more important than his life or death. And so with that, that becomes the rationale for killing him. Right? I mean, I'll do this again. And the tension that that creates may be small enough that we can ignore it. But then what happens inevitably, if you're really on this path, is that sometimes in deep meditation that comes back to you. And it may not come back as a specific memory. It may come back as a kind of a restlessness, you know, inside. So this devaluing of life is the root cause of war. Right? And it's the root cause of the ecological crisis we're in. So that it's really, really important that we figure out how to live more and more harmoniously with the creatures around us. But it ain't easy. When I first moved to Sacramento in 2000, I was living in this little apartment, and I walked into the apartment one afternoon, and there was a stream of ants going across the kitchen and up the cupboard and down into the sink. And true confession, the first thought that went through my mind was, oh my God, I hope nobody sees this. They'll think I'm a poor housekeeper. And so I flipped on the garbage disposal.
Ooh.
And these ant carcasses just sprayed all over the kitchen. And I was like really horrified. And so I vowed right then and there, I was going to figure out a better way to do this. And it took a lot of time. It's, you know, a lot of it was like figuring out what they like and what they don't like and what draws them, and just making sure I cleaned up the food. And today, there are still lots of ants in our house. But they have these little tiny Argentinian ones that you don't see. But if I look around very, very carefully, you can always see one or two of them around. But if they don't find any food they like, they don't send for their buddies. You know? And it's actually a kind of a neat feeling for me to know that I actually live in the house with these, and they're not so many that it's a problem. I haven't had as good a luck with rats.
How about mosquitoes?
Yeah,
grass flies. Yeah, we live down near the American River.
Oh, you know what's a good thing for rats? Because I used to live there many years ago when I had money at Philby Ranch. All you do is have peanut butter out.
Let me tell you, I spent years on this. So our property backs up to the Greenway. So there's trees and fields and coyotes and turkeys and rats, you know, they live along the river. And mostly they like to keep to themselves. So I actually didn't mind them having them in the house. And so I went around that house with steel wool and, sealing up all the little cracks and all that stuff. And I had have-a-heart traps and I tried, you know, peanut butter and I caught some and released them, and we sealed food in containers. And after 3 or 4 years, they were still squeaking in the walls in the attic at night. There were still little holes being chewed through the macaroni boxes and the cereal boxes. And there were still little droppings in the frying pans in the cupboard. And then one day we were sitting in the family room and these rats ran across our feet. I don't know. It was just a couple. It wasn't a whole troop. But I called an exterminator the next day. And he put little traps around the foundation in the attic. And on my behalf, he caught and killed about a half dozen. And then there were no more. And so we ended the contract. And I think that, you know, rats, they can get through the tiniest. I think what really happened was that we had a shake roof on the house. And I think they're going between the shingles. And the shake roof finally wore out and we had to replace it. And so it cleared out. So now we're okay with rats.
Is that his karma or your karma?
It's mine.
So she killed him?
No, I I knew of creatures, maybe not a specific one, but for, not for me. I knew there were creatures there. I did something that, you know, I wished them harm. and I did something that resulted in their death. So that meets all four classical criteria.
So put out a hit on.
Yeah, that's right. I put out a hit on.
Can you, as far as the karma is concerned, forgive yourself and release the karma? Okay, good.
Yeah, but it's really tricky, you know, because like the more you know about this, the less you can do that. Okay, I'm going to forgive myself and kill him. No, come on, okay, I'll forgive myself. You know, you have to be really honest with yourself about this.
Couldn't you say that because rats carry diseases and things like that that you could get still in a way that's like you're not harming yourself and people around you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You'd have rats leaving their droppings in the frying pans, you know. Yeah. So it is true, but at what point? And I don't have an answer to this.
Well, the rats were taking what they were not given.
They weren't running around in robes either, believe me. all I'm saying is this is stuff that we just really have to engage. You know, the place that I still get caught is what to do with termites. You know, so if they have a exterminator and he puts these chemical barriers that keep them out, but every 4 or 5 years they break through the ramparts and start going through the studs, and you know, and I just can't afford it. You know,
that's basically a sign that says not here. You'll go somewhere else. But I like what my friend.
Yeah, but what happens is I say every 4 or 5 years they actually get into the house and start chewing through the.
Well, they've forgotten. But anyway, my friend Judy came up with a great solution. We were sitting around talking about this the other day. When you kill a fly, you say, go to heaven. And then it's all okay. Go to heaven.
Doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
Doesn't work for me.
Right, yes.
Yeah, there's a friend of mine that does the mosquitoes. Go to God.
Okay. Go to God. You introduced me to
him. So I'm working around out of time. I want to just move into the stealing one and just give you one more scenario and then we'll open back up again. Let me see if there's stuff to finish up on that. I'll just say about the killing. Maybe I won't get to the stealing, but that what I've learned over the years. You know, I haven't come to a solution. I'm not going to propose a solution to anybody. And and what happens in Dharma circles is when you talk about this stuff, everybody starts coming up with their solution to that particular problem. And that's great to hear, but I'm saying no matter what happens, there's going to be some place where it just doesn't work. And sooner or later, we have to, you know, deal with this one way or another. And I would say that over the years that I have become a lot more sensitive to what's going on inside me when I go to do these things. And that really guides me. And I do catch and release with bugs and spiders and all that stuff. And I actually feel pretty good about it. It used to be just an annoying little thing, but I actually feel pretty good about it. It's like, because what's really clear to me is that we are the most destructive species that has ever walked on this planet. We just are. You know, we wince at, you know, velociraptors in the movies or, you know, wolves or stuff like that. But boy, you know, we are taking out creatures and entire species at this incredible rate. And most of us don't feel like, you know, we're doing much damage. But you know, we really are. So I think that it's really importantly to take these precepts seriously. And again, what that means is really investigating what's going on inside. when we go to break them. And then you just have to call it. And we're never going to we're never going to get free. So there's this I'll do two things real quickly. Stealing. Anybody know Lawrence Kohlberg? He did a lot of study of moral development back in the 50s and 60s, particularly in children, how it develops. And so one of his tests, he had this question, which is a great question. You have a child who is sick, and is actually going to die. And there is a drug that can cure the child. And there's a pharmacist that has it, but he's charging an unreasonable price for it, and you don't have enough money. So what do? Do you steal it? Mm-hmm. Or do you let the child die? I hope you steal it.
You appropriate it.
I hope you steal it. I hope that you don't whitewash yourself with it. I mean, I appreciate that. But just to be really clear, because, so there's this principle in situation ethics. You're familiar with that? That says if you have one rule, you're fine. You know, you just follow that rule, you're golden. You have two rules. Be kind, don't kill. You know, protect your children, don't steal. You have two rules. Sometimes they're going to conflict, and then you need a third rule to actually sort that out. Now you got three rules. And there's not, you know, and so it just proliferates. So we could sit here. This is part of the thing about trying to figure out all these solutions, all these problems. They are endless. In the relative world, we can't anticipate all the things that might come up. The best we can do is actually be really clear, honest with ourselves, see where our mind heart is, understand what your motives are. Killing, kindness. You know, I was really going for the kindness with Susie. When you go to slap the mosquito, go to God. Oh, I'm sending him off to the afterlife. You know, really be clear about what your motive is. Just find a way to talk yourself out of it.
What if he's going for something more?
Pardon?
What if he's going for my world sweater?
Yeah. So what do you do?
Kill him.
So just be really clear, because you can hear it in your voice, right? Kill him. And what I'm suggesting with all this is that my experience in dealing with this is I am a lot more ethical and a lot more sensitive than I was, and it comes from engaging these mindfully and heartfully. That the I just want to read this last stuff. For a precept to work must be taken seriously. If we're willing to just simply dismiss it because it's emotionally inconvenient, then it's not very helpful. We're really likely to get caught in unbalanced feelings. On the other hand, mechanical adherence to precepts creates a mind heart that is what? It's rigid and righteous when you stay within the precept, and it's rigid and guilty when we don't. And I'm sorry, but rigidity, righteousness, and guilt are not going to get us enlightened. They are not wholesome qualities. On the other hand, kindness, clarity, they really are. So for me, what it always comes down to, and it's, you know, go back to situation ethics. What's the one principle I hold most deeply behind all that? It's actually kindness. And how that plays out is going to be different in different situations.
Isn't there a difference between insects and animals? I love animals. I love fish. I love dogs, cats. You know, horses and all that, but insects, I mean...
Oh, yes, insects, they're less than us. Can you hear that? You know, I saw it in our house, you know, because we have these cats would be outside and they catch a bird. And everybody runs outside, you know, to rescue the bird, catch a lizard. Nobody does anything.
Yeah.
So what the Buddha was talking about was actually sentient beings. And those mosquitoes, at their core, you know, they don't have a terribly sophisticated neural network, so I doubt that they can really reflect on their life. But at the core, they just want to live out their life. Mm-hmm. And so who are we to say that we can off them because it's just more convenient for us? I have. And sometimes I do. Those termites, you know, destroy my house. Pardon?
Didn't the Buddha say something along the lines that all life on earth is sacred?
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't mean that I judge somebody that killed a mosquito or anything like that.
Right.
But yeah, I can live with all life is sacred.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And to just reiterate it, that there is no way to put together a set of rules that we can live within and be safe. I'll tell you one last story. It's in my book. There was this Zendo in North Dakota. Do you guys know this story? And they got cockroaches. They were running over people. They were getting in the flour and all that stuff. And they did all the things you're supposed to do. Eucalypt, and they couldn't get them out of there. And so they were wondering, maybe this is a place where it really is okay to kill, you know, given the collective harm they're doing and everything else. So they went to their Zen master to say if this was okay to put some poison out for those. So what do you think the Zen master said?
Go ahead.
He said, move.
He said, I'm not going to tell you. Because from his perspective, for them to be wrestling with the value of this life against our convenience is much more important than anything else. So we really have to engage these. And if we're willing to dismiss them, you know, when it's emotionally inconvenient, it doesn't work. If we try to follow them literally, we get into a lot of trouble on all kinds of levels. We really have to engage these heartfully and mindfully. And I don't think there's any, as long as we're living in the relative world, that's all we've got. You have to decide for yourself. That's where I come out with it. That's where I come out with it. So, it's 10 after. So let's take just a few moments. So I invite you, as you sit here, to just feel your own energy, just to be with yourself. Just open your awareness in your heart. To yourself. And then let that awareness spread out. And just feel the people around you in this room. Just sense them. And then imagine your field of awareness spreading out beyond this room, out around the town, out around the planet. We live in this sea of relationships. The squirrels and birds outside my window have the intelligence of a small child. We have very complex relationships with a small child. We live in this vast sea of relationships. Where everything we do in a large or small way affects everything else. So right now, as a Sangha, let's send out through all those connections this simple wish. May all beings know kindness. May all beings have ease and well-being as they go through. May all beings know their true nature. May all beings be deeply happy. May all beings be free. May it be so.